We are now going to tackle John Locke, the first of the British empiricists. Locke lived between 1632 and 1704, and as a young man he studied first for the ministry. He was a student at Oxford. But the Great London Fire of 1666 changed his mind, and he decided to go into medicine and became a friend of Lord Shaftesbury, and then later his private physician. Locke lived through a time of great upheaval in England, because this is the era of the English Civil War. What had happened here is that Charles I ascended the throne in 1625 and immediately began to behave like an absolute dictator at a time when Parliament, the English Parliament, was clamoring for more power, that they should have. Parliament should have more and the king less. And the populace was more and more inclining to the writings of the reformers. So a greater segment of the population was becoming overtly Protestant, quoting Luther and Calvin and so on. And part of the legacy from Henry VIII was that the Church of England was the official church of the country, and that the king, whoever was monarch in England, was head of the church as well as the state. That way the king appointed the bishops, not the pope. And that had been in place now for a long time, since the late 1530s under Henry. So you have to remember that the king is not only head of the state, but head of the church. And if you are someone who thinks the church needs to be reformed, the only way to do that is to reform the state and limit the power of the king, because otherwise the king's the one in charge of the church as well. So Charles I ascends the throne in 1625 and begins to assume to himself more and greater powers, and at times ignores Parliament, at times dismisses Parliament. It causes great upset in England, and eventually it broke out into a civil war. Civil War ended officially, completely, in 1651, though most of the hostilities and the big battles were behind, in advance of that date. But what happened here in this war is that at first Charles I succeeded. After all, he's the one with a professional army, and his dukes were people wealthy enough to have their own private armies, which is why a king, if he wanted to make war, had to get the backing of his dukes. That's where we get the expression, put up your dukes for a fist fight. You've got to collect the people that are allied and taking your side of it. So they went to war against the Puritans, the party in Parliament that wanted to reform the church, and knew that to do that they'd first have to reform the state. And so they were agitating for more limitations on the monarch's power, greater powers to the Parliament. They wanted to expand Parliament. They wanted to do a number of things. They got to be a majority in Parliament. They appointed someone, I forget who it was, to head the army. And they went to war with Charles. And at first the king won the major battles. And when things looked pretty bad for the Puritans, the Puritan representative in Parliament of the city of Cambridge, Oliver Cromwell, went before Parliament and proposed that he take over the headship, the command, as commander of the army. I don't know how much military experience Cromwell had had. He had served in the militia earlier in his life, but I don't think it was any great stuff. He certainly didn't go to war college. He didn't train with generals to be a general, but he had a natural genius for the military. And he whipped the Puritan army into great shape and began winning battles. As the dukes saw that, the dukes of the high nobility in England saw that, they more and more went to the king's side and supported him, because they realized that one of the things the Puritans wanted to do away with was levels of classes of society. There's the monarch, there's the royalty, there's the nobility, other people with a royal title, duke, marquis, baron, earl. And then there are the commoners, who are divided pretty much into those that are in business and have money, and the poor farmers. They wanted, instead of having a society in which you were born into that class, and so if you're a noble, you're going to inherit a title and lands and money, and if you're not, too bad for you. If you can manage to go into businesses, middle class, you may make wealth, but you don't have a title. And that doesn't mean you're going to sit in Parliament, or that your interests are going to be represented in the Parliament. So they wanted that expanded. They wanted the conditions for being a member of Parliament not to be whoever owns land, but whoever pays any taxes. If you're paying for government, you should be able to be represented in the government. That's a Puritan idea. Okay, so what happens? The Puritans become a majority in Parliament. Cromwell has to be appointed as commander of their army. He starts to win battles, and while that's going on, the Parliament votes to cut the king's salary. You can imagine how that went over with the king. Charles I was outraged. And he stormed down with some of his guards with him, stormed to the House of Commons, and flung open the doors and stormed in. The Speaker of the House was presiding over a meeting of the House of Commons, and he walked up to the Speaker, who knelt before the King, and he said, "I demand to know the names of the people that proposed the bill that cut my salary." And the Speaker replied, "My Lord, I have neither eyes to see, nor ears to hear, nor mouth to speak, save as this House gives me leave." Gutsy guy. Now the King can either have the Speaker of the House arrested and taken away in chains, which will cause a complete uproar, or he can back down in front of all the members of the House. And he stood for a while. The reports say he turned red in the face, and finally he just stalked away and left. He didn't arrest the Speaker, who told him that he couldn't answer him unless the House gave him permission. That's the kind of opposition that was going on. Ever since that incident, by the way, when an English monarch goes to the House of Commons to address it, they knock. When they arrive, the door is locked. They knock, and the first time they knock, they're not admitted. They have to knock again, and then they're admitted, to remind the monarch that their monarchical powers stop at that door. This is the lawmaking body. Interesting. Well, Charles pursues the Civil War and loses. In one of the battles I read about, the Puritan forces and the King's forces were lined up in front of a great meadow, which would be the next day's battlefield. But that night it rained, and the battlefield now is all muddy. So the king says, well, we can't use cavalry today. The horses will slip and fall. It'll be a disaster. You can't mount a charge across mud. So they sent their soldiers into the field without being backed up by any horse. Cromwell had the cavalry trot. So there's no charge, but the horses are just slowly trotting. And now you have a bunch of foot soldiers on the ground facing other soldiers mounted on a 1,000-pound horse. As I said, there are these strokes of genius that he had. Anyway, the Puritans win the war. They take the king captive. And now they present the king with a list of their demands. If you want to remain king and you want to remain alive, here's what you must do. You're going to sign this. It's going to say that you'll never again try to be an absolute monarch. What Charles had been doing is looking across the channel at Louis XIV, the famed Sun King, who had everything his own way, who, when his advisors told him that the state would never stand for this policy, he replied that he was the state. L'état, c'est moi. I am the state. That's me. In England, they could never get away with that, right? Because the parliament's independent. Louis XIV singled out all the men with power and lent them money. And now they can't protest his policies or he'll ask for the loan to be repaid. He had in a lot of ways, he could more easily become an absolute monarch in France than Charles ever could aspire to in England. And he tried and he failed. And now there's this list of demands. The monarch will never be a Catholic, because they still feared a monarch taking orders from Rome. They wanted to keep the monarch as head of the church in England, so he would appoint the bishops and not the Pope. There were a whole bunch of these lists in this agreement that they got from him. And one of them was that he would not try to get the throne back. We'll give you a castle and you'll have so much income a year, and just go there and retire. Promise that you'll never again try to get the throne back. And Charles signed it. And it was later discovered that he was plotting to take the throne back. So now he's brought before a tribunal. They present all of the captured messages that went back and forth. They were in code, but the code breaker had broken the code. And they present him with the evidence and they condemn him to be executed. And in 1649, the King of England was beheaded. Meanwhile, they set up a provisional Puritan government, and that government was taken over by Oliver Cromwell, who had commanded the army. He declared himself Lord High Protector of England. He refused to be called king. He would not be addressed as Your Majesty. The Puritans wanted to do away with all that. Let me put this in writing as I go in front of you. Here on the left we have Charles I. He was born in 1600, took the throne in 1625 to 1649 when he was beheaded. Locke's born in 1632, lives to 1704. So he's younger, contemporary of Charles. The Civil War ends completely in 1651 because in 1649, Charles is beheaded. Oliver Cromwell, these are his dates, the dates of his life, takes over as Lord High Protector and establishes a Puritan government in England. Now, that sounds a little weird, and it was. Here you have the head of the Church of England is supposed to be the monarch, and there's no monarch. It's still the Church of England, but the government's Puritan, and they favor a Presbyterian-type organization of the church. The majority of the clergy went along with that. majority of the people didn't. So you've got quite a mix up and a mess. The majority of the clergy favored the Presbyterian polity. The official church is the Church of England, supposed to be headed by the monarch, and there is no monarch. And the majority of the people want something freer than that. Now, this had been a sore point because Charles I, I said he behaved like an absolute monarch. Here are some examples. They concern the church. As far as Charles was concerned, we have a Church of England. You live in England, you go to the Church of England. I don't want to hear this stuff that you're a Catholic or a Quaker or a Presbyterian or a Baptist or something like that. And he had people arrested for attending other kinds of services. He had them fined. He had their ears cut off. He's the king. If I say that you go to the Church of England, you go to the Church of England. People are saying we follow our conscience. We think Luther was right about that. And just one mess. So, as I say, it turned into a civil war and the king lost. So now Cromwell is head of the Puritan government, and things continue under his rule, and I have Puritan government down here. And the Puritan government was supposed to be a relief from a monarch trying to become an absolute dictator. But the Puritan government, in some ways, was worse than what it replaced. The Puritans were opposed to frivolity. You had to live a sober and serious life. And fun and games and dances and parties, they frowned on all of that. Eventually, they outlawed it. And they even outlawed the celebration of Christmas. Now, if that puzzles you, let me point out that they knew then that Christmas was a Christian takeover of a pagan holiday. There was a pagan holiday right around the end of December, and it was intended to celebrate the fact that although the sun's light had been waning all through the fall, around what we call the 21st of December, it began to wax again and come back. So there's this pagan celebration. Yes, the sun's coming back again for another year. We're not going to freeze to death. And the sun is a god, so we are going to honor this god on this day. So they knew that then. So Cromwell's government says that's a pagan holiday and you're not to celebrate it. So if you're caught bringing a tree inside a house and decorating it, you're going to get a fine. And if you attend a church service where they're going to sing carols and blah, 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 but all the rest of Christmas stuff, then you may spend a while in jail. That's from the Puritan government that didn't want an absolute dictator. Good imitation. Cromwell divided the entire country into military districts and set an officer of the army over each district. So you've gone from a monarch who wants to be an absolute monarch to a military dictatorship that isn't any better. The average person did not like the Puritan government. They had cut the king's salary and they had favored Presbyterian polity. I've already told you about those. They're listed under here. Well, what happened was that Cromwell developed a ureter stone, and he died of uremic poisoning. And when he died, one of the prominent figures on the continent wrote that a little tiny stone had done what all the armies of Europe couldn't do, kill Oliver Cromwell. So he died in 1658. And for a while, there was a party that wanted his son to succeed him as the military Lord High Protector. In other words, on the model of monarchy. But the son didn't have the ability. He wasn't naturally cut out to be a leader. And even the people who favored the Puritan government recognized that. And after attempting to take charge, he failed. And so the powers that be, that is the nobility, the people with the money and the people who have their own private army and so on, along with Puritan approval, go to Charles II, the son of Charles I, who fled when the Civil War broke out and has been living in the Netherlands, where he was safe. And they go to him and they ask him to come back, we'll restore the monarchy, and you will be the new king. So in 1660, Charles II begins his reign in England, and that period following that is called the Restoration, meaning the restoration of the monarchy. All right. Charles II then dies, 1685. He's succeeded by James II. And James II, it violates everything about the settlement agreement. Remember, back when the Puritans had said to Charles I, you can remain alive, we'll give you a castle, we'll give you a pension, you can live out your life, you just have to sign this agreement. And it was, he would never become a Catholic and he would never seek to regain the throne and blah, blah, blah. They had a similar settlement agreement. They had a similar agreement with his sons. They bring Charles II back and the monarchy is restored in 1660, but on the condition that he signed this. He promises he'll never be a Catholic. He'll not try to be an absolute dictator. He recognizes the supremacy of Parliament as the law-making body, blah, 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 on and on and on. Okay, so he signs it. And in secret, he became a Catholic anyway. But there was nothing so bad as to cause an uproar. So people just let it go. Now, when he's succeeded by James II, the settlement agreement that Charles II had to sign was presented to James II. You need to sign this or you're not going to be king. So he signs it. And he is a Catholic. And his administration is not doing so well in a number of respects. And even the nobles who wanted the restoration of the monarchy in order to preserve nobility and keep their own position, along with the Puritan party, think that James II's administration is a disaster. So they go to James and they tell him something similar to what they had said to Charles I. We're going to give you a castle and a pension, and you can go there and live your life and have your parties and all that stuff, whatever you want to do, but you're not going to be king anymore. And they go to the next nearest relative of the last king, who is a nobleman living in the Netherlands, William Prince of Orange. Orange is the last name of the royal house in the Netherlands. William of Orange. And his wife Mary. And they bring them over to be king and queen. They rule jointly. And that takes place in 1689. William and Mary were very popular. Their reign was marked by stability and good administration and greater advances in the supremacy of Parliament. And they were admired in the colonies too. In the United States, one of the first colleges built was called the College of William and Mary, that in honor of them. Now that's the background of the time in which Locke lives. So you have to understand, when the war breaks out, Lord Shaftesbury goes to the continent. Locke goes with him. He's not going to stay there and get blown up or something. like being caught in the middle of a battle somewhere. He's not a military man, he's a doctor. Okay, I think that's enough, but I found that very few students have any idea what was going on, the who, what, when, where, why of all this background to these thinkers. It explains some of what was going on prior to the time of the American Revolution. Most Americans only get taught in school what happened during the Revolution. They know about George III, but they have no idea who George I or II was, or what, anything that happened before them or after George III. We get done with the American Revolution, we declare independence, and then we're taught history only of America. And so Europe then disappeared and ceased to do anything, and far from the truth. So I've filled in a little, and we're going to go ahead now with Locke himself. The Civil War had been fought over who would be supreme, the Parliament or the King. The King said, "It's me." And the Parliament and the Puritans said, "No, it isn't." These are people who are practical people in the sense that they don't live like nobility, like the continental rationalists, not Spinoza so much because he worked as a lens grinder, but for Descartes and for Leibniz, there's no problem about a living. They were taken care of by nobility with money. But Locke has to be a doctor. And of course, he's also a rationalist in the sense that he certainly believes in the logical method of reasoning and mathematical for proving things in science and so on. It's a nice combination, a nice life for him. He just stays away from the war and the controversy. So his first project, as I said, was how to find out how we're going to think about how the mind operates. What is it that it can and can't know? And instead of taking as the prototype for all reasoning, math itself and logic, he takes normal perception. And as I said to you before, I think that's absolutely right and it's on to something, but unfortunately, he took normal perception to mean individual little things called sensations, which are color patches, heard sounds, felt tactile sensations, tastes and smells, and that's what everybody initially deals with. That's what's given to the mind. I can't emphasize strongly more enough what a gross mistake that is and how that it wrecks their chances of giving a real account of the world we live in. And because none of them then, since these supposed objects of direct perception have only sensory properties, they can't get to any other kind of properties. They try like crazy to show how we might be able to infer the existence of something physical from these sensations, but it can't be done. And Hume wraps it around their neck. Big time. So they come to the process and of philosophy with a number of assumptions. One assumption is there are two kinds of realities in the world. And it won't surprise you to hear, these are minds and bodies. Minds and bodies. They also have an assumption, as I said, that what is given inexperienced. The given inexperience are sensations. And by that, they do not mean sensation of a table, a chair, a person, a window, a house. No, they mean color patches, sounds, tastes, smells, tactile sensations of touch. That's what comes to us. And the majority of these guys held that they come to us singly and we bundle them into things. So they are not starting with what is really given to us, meaning when we use our senses, this is what comes in, this is what we get. And I'm saying the real answer to that is things, events, states of affairs that are complexes of things and events, persons, relationships, and more. Nope. We have to construct those out of individual sense perceptions that have only sensory properties. You can smell the doomed failure. Don't have to go any further than that. So, this is what's given in experience. And for that reason, there's another assumption. What we experience is inside of us. It's internal. And there you've lost the whole world already. What we experience isn't the world around us. We're not experiencing the surfaces of objects like the door and the walls, the books behind me and so on. No, we're what we experience are little teeny individual color patches, sounds, tastes, touches, and smells, and they are inside here. Now they knew about images on retinas. They knew about that stuff long before there was a man, his name I forget now, should remember him. He was in a slaughterhouse and he picked up the eye of a bull and was fascinated to find that wherever he pointed it, there was an upside down image of whatever he pointed at on the retina of the eye of the bull. And it led everybody to jump to the conclusion, oh, then when we're seeing something, we're not seeing that object, we're seeing an image on a retina. And of course, it's easy to say that gets transmitted by the optic nerve to the occipital lobe of your brain, where it's transmitted into something else, brain processes of some kind. That's what we're really experiencing. So we get this ever internalized, more internalized idea of how perception works. What we're perceiving when we see something is a little teeny representation inside us. We're not perceiving the object. Second assumption they all make. First, there are minds and bodies. Second, what's given to experience are sensations. Third, sensations are inside our minds. So now how do we get to an external world that exists independently of you and me? Well, they try. Locke tries it. And Locke fails. And Berkeley is going to follow it up by saying, no, the world is all the sensations in all the minds. It's not really outside. And Hume's going to even attack that. So, okay. There are only sensory qualities to things, and the things are inside our minds, or if you're a materialist, they're inside our brains, because there are no non-physical minds. Well, What else did they assume? They also assumed then, and then they tried, they assumed this is true, but tried to justify it, tried to give arguments for it, and that is the internal sensations are copies of external realities. So it starts out with Locke wanting to defend that. Locke wants to say that the sensations that we have are internal little images, little copies, like the image on the retina of that bull's eye that that guy held up. Little image copies, and that's how we know there's an external world, because our perceptions are faithful copies of what is outside of us, the external world. So there's an internal world we're immediately in contact with and conscious of, and it is a faithful representation of an external world with which we are never in direct contact. We're always in direct contact with these citizens of our mind, these things that live and exist only in minds. Now, some of those things are going to be given up by the second of these thinkers, George Berkeley. He's going to say that they're not copies of external things. Or does he? Well, there's some controversy about that. There are some places where he seems to say that there is something external to which these might correspond, which they might faithfully copy. But for most of his writing, he held that that reality consists of minds and the sensations that are in the minds. So I'm not going into who's right and which way to interpret Berkeley. Just going to say that's what happens. So let's go back and stick with our initial figure in this Locke, which is Locke. Remember that Descartes thought that he could prove that there was an external world from the fact that we all, from the common sense standpoint, everybody believes there is. But they also believe that they're in direct contact with it. When the average person thinks that what they are seeing is the book on the shelf, not a perception inside their mind, and it's the book on the shelf they can go and page through and look something up. They are in direct contact with the external world. Locke's not doing that. And Descartes' proof, of course, started with proving the existence of God. And then the fact that God was all perfect and couldn't deceive us meant that our natural inclination to believe we were in contact with real external objects had to be right, or God was deceiving us. Locke has no inclination to start that way. Let's examine the mind. So Locke started out that the way to discover nature was to look for the sources of the ideas of the things that are in the mind. And his first major conclusion was that the mind itself is a tabula rasa, a blank tablet. The mind itself doesn't contribute anything to our experience. The mind is a blank tablet on which sensation writes. So it's just like a blank slate, or like this little electronic blackboard I'm using. It's a blank slate, and then I write something on it, and that's how we experience that something. That's number one conclusion. Needless to say, that's not a conclusion any modern thinker would agree with. We don't think that the mind contributes nothing to our experience. And we know that unconscious beliefs can unconsciously influence even the way we see something. And the guy who's going to come along and really rub that in is Kant. He's going to ask the question, how much of our experience is our own contribution? And he's going to give an answer I don't think is right at all. But when he gets done, it's almost everything. So that's down the road. And you see then Freud's discovery of the unconscious and exploiting that insight into ways to treat people with psychoses and so on, just is in that same tradition of the mind contributes, the mind does stuff to what we know, and it shakes it and so on. So that's number one for Locke. We start with experience. Experience is this reduced idea of the objects of experience. They're just little sensations in our minds, not the objects around us in the world. And then he adds that these sensations are inside our minds, and while the mind itself, however, is a completely blank tablet, and sensation, it metaphorically writes on it, puts things there. Locke is attacking here the idea or the belief that there are innate ideas. And what this means is ideas that are inborn in us. Innate means inborn. Now, the rationalists all put a great deal of stock in innate ideas. They agreed we have sensory perception and we try to explain the world that we perceive, but we do it largely in terms of the innate ideas. And what are the innate ideas? Well, they're the laws of logic and mathematics. We have either the ideas themselves are innate or the capacity to think of them is innate. And why did they say that? Why did they think they had to say that? Very good reason. When you formulate a law, you're formulating a statement that begins with all. In logic, that's called a quantifier, and this is the universal quantifier. All x's, let's say, are y's, right? Doesn't matter what x and y are. A law statement in physics or in biology, in psychology, in mathematics, in logic, any law statement is a universally quantified statement. It says all these are like this, no exceptions. Okay. How would you ever know that from experience? If you tried to justify this by perceptions, how many times would you have to see that when we have an X, it's Y? Or that Y follows X? Okay, every time we get an X, we're going to get a Y. How many times does that have to happen in order to prove to you that it always must be like that? And the answer is there's no finite number of times that could prove that. If it happened, if you saw Y follow X a billion times, that wouldn't show that on the billion and first it could fail. So you see X and Y, and you see the X's and then they're followed by Y. Or every X has a Y. It's a property. That doesn't matter. It's still a universal statement. How can you get any universal statement from finite number of experiences? And Hume's big on wrapping that around their necks. You can't do that. Now, the rationalist answer was, Those ideas, like the laws of logic and the laws of mathematics, are innate. We don't get them from sense experience. We don't generalize over a number of distinct individual occasions on which Y followed X. Well, that's not how we arrive at it. We arrive at it because we see Y's follow X, and it triggers something in our innate abilities, and we recognize it's a law. And now we can formulate laws of logic and laws of mathematics. For example, in this case, suppose I wanted to say that A's are followed by B's, and then how would I ever know that all A's are followed by B's? And the answer is, it triggers an innate idea. I recognize, sorry, I recognize it to be a law. And it's only that is going to answer the question as to how you can know it's true of all. So when I see that 1 and 1 makes 2, I'm seeing a law. And Leibniz commented about this. 1 plus 1 makes 2 is an eternal, immutable, that's changeless, truth that would be so whether there were things to count or people to count them. Because the mathematical laws, the logical laws, are all Platonic kind of entities. They're in another realm. There don't have to be things to count. 1 and 1 is still 2. And the only way any world that you could count and perceive can occur is to be such that all of these truths govern it. All the mathematical laws govern it. Mathematical and logical. So they had a theory of innate ideas, and Locke wants to junk that. Locke wants to say, the mind's a blank tablet, that what puts stuff onto the tablet is sensation, no innate ideas. Then how is he going to answer this question about how you can know that all A's are B or something like that, or that 1 and 1 always makes 2? Well, Bach argues that nobody yet discovered anything new about the world by putting down these supposedly innate ideas on paper and working just with them. You can't discover what reality is like. Nothing can be true and false in the same sense at the same time doesn't tell you what's true. The whole is bigger than its parts, than any part of it. Okay, wonderful. How far does that get you? Nothing. Locke makes fun of the whole process. The so-called rational truths don't get you anywhere. You have to work with sensations of the world, and then you apply the laws of logic and math. And this is the way Newton had proceeded. And of course, in referring to that, he's appealing to the towering genius of this era. Everybody else in this era, if asked for the greatest genius of them all, they all would have said it's Newton. When Newton started out, physics was just a few disparate facts nobody saw any connections between. Nobody saw any connection between the fact that objects fall to the ground if you let go of them, and they're heavier than air, and you're in the gravitational field of the Earth, they're going to fall down. Nobody saw any connection between that and the Earth revolves around the Sun. Or between that and the further you get from an object, the less its gravitational pull becomes. Newton formulates all that. He gives you logical, mathematical formulae for calculating them. So it's not just that objects fall to the ground, but every object exerts a force, a pull, on every other object, directly proportional to the mass of the objects and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. Now you got a way to figure it out. And it applies to all objects, not just me dropping my pen to the floor, but the Earth going around the sun. And you could get, and he formulates laws of motion. Galileo had formulated the law of free fall. We put all this stuff together. Now we start explaining the cosmos by use of these laws. So Locke here is the champion of the observable and trying to explain the observable in terms of other things that are observable and are hypotheses, but doing so in a logical way, but not to the extreme of the continental rationalists. Yet Locke says of them, the dogmatists, that's what he's calling them, in other words, they're just dogmatically insisting they know this law. They call all their pet ideas innate, and so they hope that we will accept their opinions uncritically. Whereas their only defense is that by rejecting them, we have destroyed the foundations of knowledge and certainty. And he wants to show how that's not true. As opposed to all that, Locke puts forward a theory that's very naive. And it is that metaphor of the mind as a closet. In fact, the Latin word for that is camera. We call the object that takes pictures a camera. It's got a dark chamber inside. Dark chamber, that's the mind. And he claims that the superior of this is that things that appear in there to us, or copies of the things outside that appear to us, are nevertheless representatives of the world around us. So he puts forward this metaphor of the mind being like a camera and an empty room into which come perceptions through a slot. And the slots are eyes and ears and mouths, touches, at finger ends and things like that. And that's how the sensations get into this dark, otherwise empty chamber. The reference here is to a camera. They knew about cameras then. They had what was called camera obscura. And Vermeer, for example, the famous painter, used one to project images of things onto the canvas, which he then traced. They didn't take a permanent picture, but they produced an image of what, an upside-down image of whatever you pointed them to. So he pointed at the room, and then he'd get the exact image of the room, and he'd go around, and that was the beginnings of his paintings. Of course, that not demeaning them at all. He's a stunning, outstanding artist. And maybe he got the outline of the shapes that way, but not the gradations of color that are so fantastic and subtle. Enough of that. Locke wants to treat the mind as a camera, empty to begin with, fed its contents by sensation, and not by ideas that are innate. So it's as though this empty room is populated by sensations. And not innate ideas. So we're going to be interested to see how Locke defends knowing laws as we go on. And we're going to continue with him next time. And if all goes well, I plan to finish him next time we meet. Or it may run over a little bit more. But it's a complicated thinker who's doing something people hadn't, at least in his opinion, they hadn't done before. They hadn't tried to analyze the mind itself in its operations and say, therefore, come to conclusions about what it can and can't know. And that we continue next time. As I usually close by saying, to the reading, read over it again, review this video if you need to, and be prepared to write about it.